Thank you all for coming. Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our second case on our oral calendar for today is A19-1438, Kenneth Howland et al. Versus Ryan Richard Jaszewski. I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Jaszewski.
Okay, thank you. Yaz. Okay, counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments and respond at 15 minutes after that. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal after, if you so choose to use that. Feel free to adjust the podium up and down to accommodate for height. And when you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Your Honor, my name is Paul Schaefer. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Ryan Richard Jaszewski. Thank you, Your Honor. We're here on a case of a family law case that is as a result of a killing that occurred in Duluth, Minnesota back on June 2nd on 2019. And in this case, the father, that would be Ryan Richard Jaszewski, is accused of murdering his wife, Nicole Jaszewski, and they have three minor children, ages 4, 6, and 8. And in this case, the maternal grandparents, the Hovlands, the respondents in this case, filed an emergency order for protection in the district court as a result of my client, Mr. Jaszewski, being incarcerated and nobody being available to take care of the children. His parents, the paternal grandparents, live in Proctor, Minnesota, which is right next to Duluth, so about 5-10 miles away. Mr. Jaszewski's sister also lives in the community and is married and has her own children. So there were his parents took care of the children after he was taken into custody on June 2nd of 2019. I believe it was that the next day that the emergency parenting. I'm sorry, Your Honor, that the emergency ex parte motion for temporary legal and physical custody was filed. That would have been actually on June 6th, I'm sorry, Your Honor. On June 17th, that emergency ex parte motion was set on for a hearing in front of Judge Teresa Neo, who was not the signing judge. The original signing judge was Judge Eric Hilden. And on June 17th, the date that the emergency ex parte motion for temporary physical and legal custody was heard, the Judge Neo, without any kind of evidence being taken into account from my client, had granted permanent legal and physical custody be granted to the maternal grandparents, the Hovlands. Mr. Jaszewski is appealing that on the basis that his procedural due process rights are violated. He had made a request on June 17th for
I want to understand, do we need to reach the procedural due process issue, or is this, have you really raised a question of Minnesota law, is it established that, in fact, an evidentiary hearing has to be held in order to make an award of custody to a third party under our statutory framework? I know you're familiar with it.
Yeah, and that is the argument, Your Honor, that evidentiary hearing would have had to have been held, especially upon his request.
But what I'm trying to ask you, and I didn't do it very well, is that as a matter of constitutional law, do we have to look at the Constitution, procedural due process, or can we reach that decision based on statutory law and Minnesota Supreme Court decisions?
Your Honor, I think we can do it on the basis of Minnesota statutory law and Minnesota Supreme Court
decisions. Okay, so help me out with that. So what is the case or the statutory provision that you think supports your position to overturn the district court's permanency decision?
Well, Your Honor, going to my brief. Let's see. Your Honor, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision that I would cite for that would be Lewis Miller versus Ross. That's a 2006 decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And in that decision, it's contemplated that evidentiary hearings for third-party custody proceedings would be held.
Right. And so help me out, because obviously I've read the case. It's cited in your brief. It's quite a different scenario from the one that we have here. That's a case where the aunt had filed a petition, supported the petition. The father was opposing her third-party petition for custody. The district court dismissed the aunt's case and didn't grant a hearing. So obviously we have a very different scenario here. We do have the father standing up in court. You made that clear in your brief, as well as in the transcript, and objecting to the court making a permanency decision at the June hearing. What we don't have is this sort of conflict in petitions that existed in the Lewis Miller case.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, it's also different in the respect of the position of Mr. Yazdzievski. He was incarcerated on the night of the killing, which would have been June 2nd. He was immediately incarcerated into the St. Louis County Jail. He has remained there up until this point in time. He had attempted to get assistance in getting counsel. Eventually, he had an initial an attorney that was helping him out with the criminal case, not so much with the family, but with the criminal. I came on a while later, I think it was on June 12th, but I might be misstating the date, but it was very shortly before this hearing. He obviously, while he was in jail, he didn't have a chance to do any kind of petition or do an answer or anything else.
And counsel, that's an interesting line of questions that I'm sure respondent will deal with in terms of the timeline here.
Yes.
I guess it still doesn't really answer my question, because we had the hearing, right, on June 17th. You stated that it was your, I believe, first appearance, at least on this case, for your client, and nothing filed by that date, but there was an answer filed later. The judge's written decision didn't come out until July 15th, which was, another several weeks down the line. Still no competing petition or competing set of paperwork presented to the judge. And I think the way the respondent phrases it in their brief is you didn't attempt to reopen the record and give the judge other facts. So why is that?
Well, Your Honor, why is that, Your Honor? The question for that, how do I answer that question? The reason that the petition was, first of all, the petition was filed after the hearing date was at the date on June 17th that the matter was heard. We anticipated that it would be set on for an evidentiary hearing, one that we would request it. When the court granted permanent custody on that date, we filed an answer afterwards simply to preserve any kind of potential procedural issues with not filing an answer. Why did the appellant not put in there why he was requesting to retain custody? Well, the reason that he didn't was...
what the position that was stated in your answer was that the father, recognizing he's incarcerated and probably facing a lengthy jail time before trial, is that he thought, I believe it was his sister, right, and brother-in-law should be, were the appropriate custodians. you know, as the district court mentioned repeatedly, not only at the hearing but in the written order, you know, that was just, there was no basis for that. There was no competing petition. The judge had no information. You know, there were things that the father could have done to have teed up his request for a different custodial award. And that's what I'm trying to understand, is why wasn't that presented to the judge?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I can only really give the court the indication that during that this time went on, that this happened. There's a lot of question of about procedurally how we were proceeding, what attorneys were representing who. That's not necessarily a good answer, but we felt that with the position the court had taken, grant and permanent custody, for him to have presented it differently in his response, there would have, I don't want to say there'd be no point to it, but we felt that based on what happened and the way it happened and what the attitude of the court seemed to be, would be that we were best appealing it. In his answer, he obviously nominated or said that his preference would be to go to his sister and brother-in-law. Why they didn't present their own custody petition, I don't know, Your Honor. I wasn't representing them.
So, counsel, this isn't an area I practiced in. They aren't petitions that I heard as a district court judge. So I'll be honest with you in that regard. I guess what I'm puzzling over is when I read Lewis Miller, although there were competing petitions in that case, I don't see where the statutory framework suggests that there has to be a competing petition. I mean, we have the mandate for a district court judge to determine many things to award custody, but in particular, what are the best interests of the children? And it seems to me that the statutory framework, as described in Lewis Miller, anticipates that that's going to be done in two stages. We have proceedings here that seem to stop after the first stage and didn't go to the second. So is that the way you look at it, or you know, is this a fatal error that you didn't offer a competing petition?
And, Your Honor, we don't feel that it is a fatal error. We feel that the proceedings effectively ended on June 17th. A decision was made by the court for permanent custody, not temporary custody, permanent custody.
What was the hearing on the 17th scheduled for?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that was scheduled on for the emergency ex parte motion that was filed.
That requested temporary relief?
Temporary relief.
And had there been an initial hearing scheduled, an ICMC, on the third-party petition yet? Had that even been scheduled on the permanent petition? There's two things. We have the temporary motion, and that was initially signed, temporary custody granted, pending a hearing. Then you have a separate line where you're asking for, the other side was asking for permanent relief. Was there ever a hearing scheduled on that permanent petition?
No, Your Honor.
And is there any case that you're aware of where this court has had the opportunity to review a district court's permanent custody award prior to scheduling an initial hearing on the permanent request?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge.
So, counsel, I appreciate that you've also got rebuttal time to talk to us. I just want to make sure that both parties, I think you initiated it, but both parties did write to the court asking for this argument date to be continued so you could pursue settlement discussions. And I just want to make it clear that, of course, settlement is relevant to this court. And if the parties do reach a settlement, we expect you to notify the court as soon as possible. Having said that, I assume you would let us know. And I'm not inquiring as to the status of settlement at this point. We're going to decide the case as presented. We rejected your request for a continuance. So.
Understood, Your Honor. Yeah. I could go on in my not so great presentation, but Your Honors, that is effectively where we're at here. Is that simply, you know, the way it was procedurally handled, and with a permanent custody order being put in place on a motion that was an ex parte motion that was temporary. It was filed as a temporary motion, which was turned into a permanent motion on the hearing following the initial ex parte signing of the motion. The thing that we're arguing here is that procedurally it was just wasn't proper. The appellant didn't have an opportunity to present anything to the court under that time frame, and he effectively didn't have his voice heard. So the question, of course, before the court is, the way this was handled was it the proper way? And it's our maintaining to the court that it was not, that it should not have been handled this quickly in this manner without him having any effective opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing, to effectively give his side of it. Now, the idea of him retaining custody, of course, is preposterous under the circumstances he was in. But the question does come to...
Well, he was pending charges, right? He wasn't convicted yet.
No, Your Honor. He was charged with second-degree intentional murder. He is set right now for...
Well, I mean, you said it's preposterous, but presumably he has a right to be presumed innocent.
Well, that is certainly what we've been maintained to the court. But, you know, with him being in the St. Louis County Jail, he could not have any kind of temporary custody over his children or permanent or any custody whatsoever, being an inmate in the county jail.
And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Counsel for a respondent.
May it please the court and counsel, good morning. My name is Terry Portwright. I represent Kenneth and Deborah Hovland, who are the respondents in this case and the maternal grandparents of the three children that are the subject of the appeal. The respondents are respectfully asking that this court affirm the district court's order that awarded them permanent legal and physical custody because we believe appellant failed to show that the district court abused its discretion by issuing the order and also failed to show that he experienced any harm by the decision that was made.
So, counsel, I'd appreciate it if you would start, just because it seems a logical place to start, with the line that Judge Ryan was pursuing with regard to notice. So this June 17th hearing, where most of this dispute centers on, appears to me, from reading the record, to have been a motion hearing following an ex parte order. So that the notice for that hearing was to discuss the ex parte temporary custody order. And I didn't see where it was noticed as a hearing to determine permanent custody.
Or an ICMC.
The notice that we were given was a notice on a new case file. It was not identified as an ICMC. It was not limited, excuse me, recovering from a cold. Mm-hmm. It was not limited to the ex parte motion. So it was not clear to me, and I don't think it was clear to counsel, what the limitation of that hearing
was. What do the rules require in terms of scheduling that first, the ICMC on a permanent motion with respect to time to respond?
Normally, once the person is served with the petition, they would have 20 days from the day they were served to file a response.
And is it, in your experience, common practice to have an ICMC prior to the running of the 20 days?
It's not uncommon to have it before 20 days. And it's not uncommon because in a typical case, which this is not, in a typical family law case, the attorneys would go in, we would talk about waiving the time to file an answer, and we would have agreed on that before the hearing date, and then we would schedule some sort of alternative dispute resolution.
Right, I get it.
And so if we don't resolve at ADR, then the other party still has time to answer.
And I think the Lewis Miller case recognizes in a footnote, you know, that everything it says about two-stage proceedings you know, goes as far as that's the anticipated procedure under the statute. On the other hand, that the parties can agree to something else. They can waive rights, they can stipulate to custody. You know, we all recognize that. But that, of course, doesn't help us in this case because you didn't have a stipulation.
It doesn't help us in this case, although in the Lewis case, it specifically says that the party commencing the third-party child custody proceeding by petition and affidavit is entitled to the hearing. Nowhere in Lewis does it say the respondent, which in this case is the appellant, has the right to an evidentiary hearing.
What authority do you have that a court can effectively default a party prior to the time to respond to a petition?
The court, in its decision, in its order, its written order, specifically identifies this case as having extraordinary circumstances.
So what is the basis or the authority that allows default prior to the running of time to respond?
I don't think the court addressed that in its order. The court accepted the answer even though it was the day after the hearing and references the answer in its order.
But the court did acknowledge it should have had an additional hearing. It should have had an evidentiary hearing.
I couldn't hear the beginning. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. But the district court did acknowledge it really is supposed to have hold an evidentiary hearing, right?
I think the court acknowledges that in normal circumstances there would be an evidentiary hearing.
So I guess I'm looking for the rule or the statute or the case that says there's any discretion at all for a district court to find some extraordinary circumstances that would justify default in any case, civil, family. I mean, we still follow the civil rules in family court. So summary judgment would be available in family court, intervening parties, joinder, all of those things would be normally available. Mediation provisions, all of the things that you would have in a family court case that was short-circuited here by a default. And so the question I have is, what is the statute? What is the rule? What is the case law that allows any discretion at all to find an extraordinary circumstances rule that gets around the normal practice and rules?
Under 257C.03, it clearly says who can file a third-party custody petition and affidavit. Nowhere in 257C is the phrase evidentiary hearing included. There has been a presumption by the court that it is a two-stage process, but it is not in the statute. If we then look at the Wallen case,
is there any limitation? Can the district court, for judicial economy, take a look at the petition on day one and grant permanent relief on day two and move on to the next case every single time?
I think theoretically they could, because nowhere in the plain reading of the statute does it say that anyone has the right to an evidentiary hearing. If you then go to the cases,
but are you talking about 257.03 subdivision 7B? Because there talks about how a district court can only award third-party custody without an evidentiary hearing if both parties consent to the stipulation. That doesn't seem to be the situation here, though. And the district court clearly acknowledged that by saying, well, I'm looking at the extraordinary circumstances here, and in particular that there's need for immediate action for these children. But that doesn't explain why it would be a permanent custody determination versus a temporary, even assuming that the district court had the authority to override the statute, which I don't see where the district court does. Why would it be permanent versus temporary?
Because that's what the district court did. Abuse their discretion by doing that?
And it seems like the district court did, because I'm struggling to figure out what authority the district court had to do that.
I don't want to put words into the judge's mouth, but I look at the Wallen case, I look at In Re Custody of NAK, and they talk about extraordinary circumstances. And in neither of those cases do they say we should jump steps as part of the process, but they identify extraordinary circumstances as a way in which to address what is in the best interest of the children.
And so extraordinary circumstances is definitely one of the prongs in 257C to showing that you're an interested party. I totally understand that, and I don't hear appellant as disputing that this is a case of extraordinary circumstances where your clients they have standing, and undoubtedly they would continue to have standing at an evidentiary hearing. that doesn't mean we can skip to that. I mean, just because it doesn't appear to be contested at this point doesn't mean a district court judge has authority to just skip over it.
So from my perspective, the appropriate response would have been at that hearing on June 17th, appellant's counsel would have objected after the court orally announced its decision.
So, counsel, I have to tell you that was one of the oddest things I read in a respondent's brief in a very long time, to suggest that in a hearing where a district court judge, you know, has, because it was clearly flagged that this was the direction the judge was heading in. You know, and it wasn't just the judge. The request was made by you at the hearing for the permanency decision once the judge headed down that way. And appellant's counsel, you know, then counsel for the fathers, did stand up and object and say, no, we want an evidentiary hearing. You acknowledge that in your brief. So why, after the judge announces her decision, would the father's attorney again have to stand up and say, but we asked for an evidentiary hearing? I don't understand that argument. I don't even see a basis for it in our procedural rules or our concepts of what is required to preserve error.
If it was me, I would want to protect my client's rights, and I would want to note for the record my objection
but
to the decision.
But the objection was noted. You have that in your brief. You acknowledge they made the objection.
He requested it prior to her announcing her decision. That's why, in my practice, I would have stood up and said, again, I object to this decision. I want to preserve this issue. I would have also asked the court to keep the record open so that I could have filed additional documentation. That was never done. And even after I got the decision, my practice would have been to file a request, to file a motion for reconsideration,
right,
which was not done.
And that's all fine and well. It sounds like it's a great practice that you have, but the fact of the matter is an objection was made on the record. A request for an evidentiary hearing was made by appellant's counsel to the district court. So there's clearly a record of that. So why is it not an abuse of the discretion? Why didn't the district court err by not holding an evidentiary hearing as required?
I cannot quote you any section of the law that says an evidentiary hearing is required. I can tell you that
One was requested.
Pardon?
One certainly was requested.
Certainly.
What about the rules of procedure that we have to follow that would allow for discovery, dispositive motions?
Never requested.
Well,
so, counsel, I'll point you to some language in the Lewis Miller case that I do think, you know, you can have your own view of what 257C requires, but the Lewis Miller case says, and I think you'd agree that with the first part of the statement, it's the Supreme Court said, if the petition and the affidavits alleged facts, which if proven, would satisfy the statutory criteria for third-party custody. So I think you believe, because you submitted them, that the grandparents' papers did present facts that, if proven, would satisfy the statutory criteria for custody, right, for third-party custody. But the Supreme Court goes on to say what happens next. The court would then schedule an evidentiary hearing. In this manner, it may be said that the statutory scheme contemplates a two-stage process. I mean, that's what I struggle with in looking at what happened here, is that the judge recognized that you had submitted, you could call it a prima facie case, that entitled your clients to a hearing. It didn't entitle them to automatically get permanent custody. I don't see any basis for that or authority for the district court to skip the second part of the two-stage process.
And even if you conclude that she abused her discretion by skipping that, to use your term, I think you have to ask, did the appellant suffer any harm from this? There was not a competing petition at that time. 257 requires a competing petition, and
right,
it's not there.
But appellant said that his preference would be that his sister and brother-in-law have custody of his three children. Now, nothing formal, I understand nothing formal had been filed, but he's asking for an evidentiary hearing to have that take place. And this is custody of his children. I don't see how you can say that there's no prejudice to him. Shouldn't parents, even if they, at least temporarily, can't have custody of their children, shouldn't parents have a say in terms of who should raise their children? I mean, that seems like just a fundamental issue right there, that to say that there's no prejudice, I'm really struggling with that.
Even putting aside the custody piece, isn't it still at issue some parenting time or conditions around which he could have contact, whether it's written contact or, I mean, wouldn't he still have a right to argue for those things, and isn't precluding that prejudice?
Until his parental rights would be terminated, he absolutely would have the right to ask for that.
So, counsel, I had one other question. I think we did hear from appellant's counsel on it, and I wanted to make sure we heard from you. So, you know, the hearing, like you said, the June 17th hearing was really set up as more of a new case filing review hearing type thing. So the parties were there because an ex parte order had been issued, and nobody's challenging the ex parte temporary custody order.
Correct.
So I guess what I struggled with is, what was the need to move to permanency on June 17th? I can't find that in the record, and I wondered whether it was maybe something the parties discussed off the record, which would mean it wouldn't enter into our decision. But I honestly am trying to understand, was there some underlying need? There were references made to, well, if we do this today, child protection won't get involved. I read that.
Yep.
Is that it, or is there something more?
There had been ongoing discussions between counsel. Mm-hmm. We had an in-chambers meeting prior to court. It's possible that not everything was placed on the record, which of course means you can't consider it. But there have been so many moving pieces to this case that the record does not reflect everything that was going on.
So you do agree, I mean, I assume you've read the record, you prepared your brief, so you agree with me that there is nothing in the record that indicates why the district court had to reach a permanency decision on June 17th or even by July 15th, I think, which is when the written order was issued.
There's nothing in the record that says, that addresses why.
Yeah, because I mean, that was my confusion, is why not just stick with the temporary custody arrangement until such time as an evidentiary hearing could be held.
I agree.
Okay.
I'd like to ask one additional kind of stepping back question about the standard of review here. You've referred to it as abuse of discretion. The question I have is what is the appropriate standard of review if a district court were, in a way, creating an exception to the rules of procedure? Is there any discretion that we would afford the district court in that circumstance? The exception in this case being extraordinary circumstances, as you've put it, that would be an exception to following the standard rules of procedure that contemplate respondents' rights to discovery and trial prior to losing or even addressing custody. So if there is an exception to those standard rules of procedure that is created by a district court, what is the standard of review that we would apply to that? And is it, in fact, abuse of discretion, or is it something else?
I would say based on, and I'm going to destroy the name of this case, Pikula at 374 Northwest 2nd 705. I probably mispronounced it. It says that the review of a custody determination for the Court of Appeals is limited to an abuse of discretion. I would rely on that case. I'm not aware of any other approach to review the district court's decision on a custody case.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
And I know earlier that Justice Bratfeld, you had asked me whether we could rely on Minnesota procedural standards and Minnesota procedural law and case law and so forth. But this is where the appellant would argue that we get into constitutional law under the federal government, under our U.S. Constitution, and under Minnesota constitutional law. Here we're dealing with what has been identified under the Troxell case, the U.S. Federal case of Troxell, a fundamental right, and that's to have custody of your children and to raise them. Here, we would argue that the district court, by doing what it did, by essentially formulating its own procedure under Minnesota law on proceeding from a temporary ex parte motion for temporary custody to a permanent custody order, violated his constitutional rights under both Minnesota and the U.S. our federal constitution. Under Troxell, it's been identified that one of our fundamental property interests is, besides life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, of course, and the other provisions under our U.S. Constitution and Minnesota Constitution is custody and raising of your children with your own points of view, of course, based upon unreasonableness and all the case law that follows. But in this circumstance, the court, by doing what it did, violated, we say, his due process rights. It just jumped to permanent custody. And my recollection in the courtroom that day is that just about everybody in that court was stunned by what happened. We anticipated the court to continue temporary custody order with the children until the matter could be dealt with later. But we were all just shocked that a permanent custody award was made at that time and under the circumstances that were in front of the court at that date and time. And so here is the interplay between Minnesota's rules of court, our rules of civil procedure, rules of family law procedure, our Minnesota case law, the Minnesota Constitution, and the United States Constitution. Here we have the intermingling of those concepts in a very meaningful and disastrous way for the appellant. I have nothing more, Your Honors, unless
Thank
the
you
Honors
very much,
have
counsel.
Something more for me.
I don't think so.
Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for arguments and briefing. We'll be issuing an order within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.
Thank you both.